WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
David Brinkley died at his home last night of complications from a fall. He was 82. He spent about half a century in the news business. In fact, as he pointed out, he started doing TV news before anyone was watching. And when he stopped anchoring in 1979, he said that he'd done the news longer than anyone else on Earth. Brinkley started his broadcasting career at NBC in 1943. In 1956, he was paired with Chet Huntley to cover the Democratic and Republican conventions for NBC. They worked so well together, they became the anchors of the NBC Evening News, which was given the name the Huntley-Brinkley Report. After Chet Huntley retired in 1970, Brinkley co-anchored the NBC News with John Chancellor and then became a commentator. In 1981, he joined ABC, where he began the Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley. He stepped down from hosting the program in 1996, remained on the program as a commentator, then retired in 1997. When I spoke with him in 1989, after the publication of his book Washington Goes to War, we talked about the start of his broadcasting career.
Now, you were the White House correspondent, weren't you, for, was it NBC Radio?
NBC, well, that's, radio was all it was then.
Right, okay. So, listen, I figure it must have not been considered a very important beat if such a young man or someone still really a rookie was assigned to the White House in the
early
40s.
Well, partly because I got out of the Army early, and everybody was crying for male help. Female help was not as welcome then as it is now. All kinds of changes have taken place. And the White House was not really a full-time beat. The president had press conferences twice a week, one on Tuesday morning and one on Thursday afternoon. I may have those reversed, because they were intended only for newspapers. And a reporter showed up at the appointed hour, went to the press conference, and left. And there were only five or six who were there all day, and there was no reason to be there all day because not much was happening. There was no such thing as a leak at that time.
You point out that radio became a medium that was taken seriously as a news medium during World War II. Did you take radio very seriously when you were working in it? Did you think of it as the place you wanted to continue to work? And again, this was before television.
I did take it very seriously. I thought it was terribly important during the war more than ever before. People stayed glued to the radios because we had tremendous amounts of news. And I remember putting on all kinds of things during the war that the newspapers would not have until the next morning. And there were people all over the country who kept the radio on all day long and had a map. And they put pins in the map to keep track of activity on the war fronts as the radio reported them. And we had some very, very good reporters in those days reporting the war from the war fronts. I never did that. And so radio became a very serious and highly respected news medium.
Now, I learned from your new book that NBC used to insist that after 6 in the evening, men had to wear formal attire and black tie. How long did that regulation last, and what was the rationale for it?
Well, the rationale was that NBC wanted to be considered what it was for a long time, the foremost radio network. It was a serious enterprise. Everything on the air was live. Everything. There was not even a recorded commercial. Everything was live. And they wanted to maintain a high degree of dignity and seriousness and public acceptance. And so in the photographs of radio performers at night, Fred Allen, big names in those years, all wore black tie. The announcers wore black tie. Everyone wore black tie.
Of course, no one listening to the radio could see them.
I know that.
But, I figured you'd know that, yeah.
had an effect on the... They thought it had an effect on the performance of their people.
Did you buy that yourself?
Well, I don't know. I didn't own the network, and if that's what they wanted, it was okay with me. It didn't matter.
Did you have to keep a change of clothes with you, so if you had a report after 6, you'd have your formal attire?
Yes. Yes. They stopped that eventually. I don't remember exactly what year they stopped it, but they did stop it. I think when television came along, they dropped it.
Now, was that sense of formality carried over into the voice as well? Were you expected to sound very formal, especially in the evening hours?
Well, people in radio at that time took their diction and their speech patterns very, very seriously. I remember announcers saying in tones of awe, that what's his name? I used to announce a Metropolitan Radio, a Metropolitan Opera broadcast. Milton Cross, was he Milton
yeah,
Cross?
Yeah,
yeah, Milton Cross. They spoke of him as if he were some kind of deity because he had won a prize for having the finest diction in radio. And it was good.
Now you really have perhaps the most consciously or unconsciously imitated voice in broadcasting. When did you first become aware that other people in broadcasting were picking up your inflections?
I guess the first time was when somebody ran an ad in Variety, the little show business newspaper, weekly newspaper, ran an ad in Variety offering $1,500 for somebody who could record a commercial for 1 minute using my speech pattern. And the joke at the time was that I applied for it and was turned down, which is, of course, not true, but that was the joke. I don't know anymore. I shouldn't tell this because I don't know what finally happened.
Well, while we're talking about your voice, let's talk a little bit about writing. You've been praised so much for knowing how to write a simple declarative sentence and for writing really clear, concise copy for television. How did you develop your style of writing for radio and TV?
Well, I worked for United Press, which at that time had what it called a radio wire. I guess it still has it. It goes only to radio stations, and they thought I could write well, so they put me to work writing for the radio wire. And it attracted some attention because it was pretty good, I guess, and NBC hired me as a writer to write news scripts for announcers to read, which is how the news was done then. And one reason I learned to write clearly and simply was that I had to write in such a way that the announcers, who knew nothing of what they were reading, that the announcers could not read it wrongly. And so they would emphasize the right word and not change the meaning of the sentence by emphasizing the wrong word.
Would you ever let anyone write for you? Did anyone ever write for you in your years of anchoring?
No.
Did you ever try it and have a bad experience?
No. Well, a time or two, for whatever reason, I had to read something because something happened while I was on the air. I had to read copy written by someone else, and I found I simply could not do it. I can't do it.
When you say you cannot say it, does that mean that you trip over the words?
It means that I garble it all up. So what I've always had to do, this hadn't happened much. When it did happen, I first had to read it and then ad-lib it.
Uh-huh.
I can't read other people's copy.
Does that have to do more with not liking other people's writing or more with needing sentences that fit your inflections?
The second, needing sentences that fit my inflections. I can't read other people's sentences. I simply can't.
Mm-hmm. You've said that you learned to do TV before anyone was watching, and I guess that's pretty true. And by 1950, you were doing regular reports on the, what was it called, the Camel News Caravan?
John Cameron Swayze and the Camel News Caravan. It was perfectly awful, Terry.
Why was it awful?
Well, partly because when one set out to do a television news program at that time, there was no history to go by. No one knew how to do it. It had never been done before. And you are not old enough to remember, but in the past, there were, in the movie theaters, newsreels between the features. And they were perfectly awful. They were owned by the movie studios, and mainly they used them to clear out the theater between features so people wouldn't sit through them twice. And there were dull, boring, silly stories about ship launchings, horse races, fashion shows, and so on. So when television came along and decided to do news, they didn't know what to do except to copy the newsreels, which is what they did. And the Swayze program, which I did do a little bit of, was, as I say, perfectly awful. It was ship launchings and fashion shows and other kinds of junk. No news, really. Not much.
Well, this was before there were rules about what made good television, and I would think that would leave you free to take certain risks and experiment a little.
Free to, but not really able to, because the facilities were so bad. The film was black and white. The sound was optical sound, very poor. It took forever to get film processed, and forever beyond that to get it edited. When it came from out of the city, New York or Washington, it had to be flown in and very often got lost at the airport. It was really a mess. So all we did was struggle and try to get something on the air, and that's about all we accomplished.
Well, in 1956, you became the co-anchor of the NBC News with Chet Huntley, mm-hmm. the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Was anchoring at that time considered a real high prestige position in the way that it's subsequently been seen?
Nothing like it has come to be since then. It was then thought of as a kind of interesting job. There weren't any real anchors before that. There was John Cameron Swayze, and on CBS along later came Doug Edwards. And on ABC, I don't think they were in the game yet. So there wasn't much... anchoring didn't amount to much. There wasn't much to anchor. The programs are 15 minutes long. The pictures are bad. The sound is bad. Very few people had television sets. And so it didn't really amount to much. It later came to be what it is. Whatever that is, I'm not sure I know.
Do you mind me asking a question? I know you've been asked a million times. But about how you were paired with Chet Huntley.
NBC thought at that time, the big name, biggest name in news at that time prior to that was Ed Murrow. And every network felt it had to have an Ed Murrow or somebody who sounded like him. NBC hired Chet Huntley thinking he sounded like Ed Murrow. And he was in New York and I was in Washington. For the first time they'd resolved to cover a political convention thoroughly, because finally we had some cameras and so on, were able to do it. And they were unwilling to trust either of us alone, and so they put the two of us together, thinking that if one of us screwed up, the other could save him. There have been many arguments about who was responsible for that decision, but somebody in New York made it, and we did do the 1956 convention together. And it worked very well, and it led to the Huntley-Brinkley news report in fall of 56.
Now, I understand that you really didn't like the famous sign-off that you used every night. Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Why not? It doesn't seem very offensive.
Well, it seemed silly to me. It seemed that when we said good night, we should say good night to the audience. We are there to tell them the news, not to tell each other. We're there. And I didn't think it sounded too good, two men saying good night to each other on the air. We should say good night to the audience. And I fought and argued and fought and argued and lost. The producer insisted that we say good night, Chet, and good night, David. So finally we gave in, and we did, and it became, for a long time, part of the language.
Since it caught on, do you think that you were wrong, or do you think that you were right?
Well, I don't know. Who's to say? But yeah. It caught on, and so I couldn't argue anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were first paired to cover a convention together. And you've said that you have always really liked covering conventions. You've thought of them as kind of big parties, big games, a lot of excitement. I was wondering what you felt at the Chicago convention, in the Democratic convention in 1968.
68?
Yeah.
I felt I was in a foreign country. I was shocked by what was happening out there in the streets. Students being beaten by the police. The mayor of Chicago turning out the sewer workers to fill up the auditorium to cheer him and to hold up signs saying, "We love Mayor Daley." It truly was shocking and somewhat frightening. I remember that was at about the time when the Russians had gone into Czechoslovakia to shut down the democratic movement there under Dubček. And I remember saying on the air, "Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?" Well, the mayor, needless to say, didn't like that, but it was true. I was shocked by it and infuriated by it.
Now, did you get any flack for saying that? Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?
I got some flack from Mayor Daley, but not much from anybody else. I think everybody else outside of Chicago was shocked at what happened there.
We're listening back to a 1989 interview with David Brinkley. He died last night at the age of 82. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. TV news anchor and commentator David Brinkley died last night at the age of 82. We're listening back to an interview I recorded with him in 1989. I asked him about his Sunday morning program, This Week with David Brinkley, in which he and ABC reporter Sam Donaldson analyzed and gave opinions on news stories. I asked if it had become more acceptable on TV to allow newsmen to state opinions on the air.
Obviously, when Sam is on the air with me and George and whoever else on Sunday mornings, he is not giving the news. We are having a discussion. We're not saying what happened. We're saying what we think about what happened, and it is clearly labeled. No one is deceived by it. Nevertheless, there are people who think reporters, people who report news in an objective, though I don't like that word, fashion, should not sometime later on the same station, same channel, be giving his opinions. And as I say, it's a, I can't really satisfy myself on that point. I still have questions about it.
Let me ask you this. The two people who I assume are supposed to be political balance to each other are George Will as the conservative and Sam Donaldson as the liberal. But it always seems to me that George Will is further to the right than Sam Donaldson is to the left. And I was wondering if you think of them as an equal balance.
I don't really think of it in those terms, Terry. I don't think political opinion can be measured by some kind of micrometer. What you say may well be true, but if asked to prove it, I would have a hard time doing it. George is quite conservative, and Sam is sort of liberal. He's not a red-hot, screaming left-winger, but he's sort of liberal. And he very often disagrees with George, and I'm delighted. Otherwise, we would miss a lot of chances for opinions to be exposed and discussed, because everybody agreed. It'd make a fairly boring program, actually.
Where do you think of yourself as falling in the political spectrum?
I have spent my entire working life avoiding any political label.
Mm-hmm.
The only answer I can give you is that depending on what it is, I am either a liberal or a conservative. That's no answer, I know, but I can't give you an answer. It depends on what the question is.
Mm-hmm. When people come on your show on Sunday morning, I'm sure they come on determined to just say what it is that they've decided to say beforehand, and then it's your job and the jobs of the other people on the show to try to get them to go beyond what they've prepared in advance. Is that very difficult to do, and do you think of yourself or as the other people on the program as having certain techniques of pushing people further than they planned to go?
Yes, everything you say is true. Everyone we have on the air, usually it's some sort of political figure or an academic figure or some sort of intellectual figure, every one of them will arrive in a studio with some little sermonette in mind and determined to deliver it. So one thing I do is first ask them a dull, boring question like, what do you think about this? And let them deliver their little sermonette. And then we get to the hardcore of what we're there to talk about. Let them get it out of their system before they will go into anything else.
That sermonette can be kind of long. How do you make sure it's a concise sermonette?
Interrupt.
Uh-huh.
I don't let them run on all night.
Uh-huh.
They do that before they come, and if they try to go into a filibuster, I had one not long ago, one from the SNL industry who wanted to filibuster, and I stopped him. I cut him off. I do it politely, but we do it.
You started on television before there was videotape, so you couldn't watch a tape-delayed broadcast of your show. You couldn't watch the videotape and see how you were doing. Do you remember the first time you actually watched yourself on videotape, what the experience was like?
I remember I didn't like it. And I didn't like how I looked and sounded, didn't like anything about it. And I've almost never looked at myself since. I'm serious. I mean that. Our Sunday program at 10:30 is done live. At 11:30, we play back the tape to the West Coast and so on. I could easily sit and watch it all. I never, ever watch it.
And why not?
I don't want to look at myself. I don't know why not. Maybe I'm crazy.
But do you ever think, well, you should overcome that feeling so you could see the show and critique it and see if there's anything you wanted to change? Or...
Well, since I was on it, I know what is on the program,
right.
And I know what I think was pretty good and what I think was less than good, and so I don't really need to do that to critique it. But as for looking at myself, it really doesn't appeal to me.
David Brinkley recorded in 1989. He died last night at the age of 82 of complications from a fall.